Welcome to the Versus History Podcast with your hosts, Patrick O'Shaughnessy, Connell Smith, and Elliot Watson.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to this episode of the Versus History Podcast. It's me on behalf of the editors, Patrick O'Shaughnessy at History Chappie. But the special event and main feature today is Wolfson History Prize nominee. And also, if that were not enough, this is from her Twitter bio, the chaired professor of the Hebrew Bible, an ancient religion at Exeter University. Very nice. Geeky, Greeky, and an atheist. And she's written a book entitled God and Anatomy. It's Professor Francesca Stavrakopoulou. Francesca,
hi.
Professor. Hi. So thank you so much for joining us. How are you today?
Oh, I'm all right. It's a gorgeous day and I'm in the middle of trying to write a complicated article. But apart from that, I'm okay, thanks. How about you?
Yeah, I'm all good. I'm all good. Delighted you're with us. Well, welcome to a very uncomplicated interview here at Versus History. So just to get the proverbial ball rolling for our listeners, tell us a little bit about you, academically or otherwise, and your background. Go for it.
So I'm a professor of Hebrew Bible and ancient religion at the University of Exeter, which basically means that I specialise in the ancient cultures and societies that gave rise to the texts that we find in the Bible today. So I work in quite a weird context because I work in a theology and religion department, and that's a field that's predominantly peopled by those of a confessional persuasion, whether it's Christian or Jewish or Muslim. But I'm not confessional or religious at all. I'm an atheist. I always have been. I always will be. And I study these ancient cultures and texts because I think they're so damn interesting.
Well, that's as good a reason as any, I suppose. So what's your book all about then, Professor? And why did you choose to write it? Go for it.
This book is, in some ways, it's the book that I've always wanted to write. It's about the early career of God. So in other words, from his very ancient origins in late Bronze Age, Southwest Asia, and in particular, the Levant. So the area that we refer to today as Israel, Palestine, Jordan, Lebanon, Western Syria. So it's about the rise of this deity who was known, whose proper name is Yahweh. And it's about the ways in which he gradually changed over time, and is basically the God of the Bible as we find that deity portrayed today. But I take this kind of cultural tour of his origins by mapping out, controversially for some people, by mapping out his body. We tend today to think of the God of, you know, Christianity and Judaism as an immaterial God. So a God who has not got any kind of body or materiality at all. But that's not the way in which his ancient worshippers understood him. They understood him very much to be a God with a human-shaped body.
I suppose that segues nicely onto the final question. So I'm going to mix up the order because we've mentioned this very sort of exoteric nature of God, this physically manifest being. So to quote, examining God's body from head to hands, feet and genitals, you attempt to show how the Western idea of God has developed. So the question is, could you unpack that a little for us? I mean, in layperson's terms, what does it actually mean? And how did that or does that mean the physicality of God may have an impact in some way on and if it does have this physical nature, how does that sort of correlate to the more esoteric aspects of belief in the divine, which I suppose are more prevalent in modern Western Christianity, I guess?
Yeah, so this notion that we have that the divine is immaterial and incorporeal, it's basically a reflection of, broadly speaking, Hellenistic philosophical positions, primarily sort of Neoplatonic ideas, in which for the divine to truly be divine, it has to be completely and utterly other to anything else in the universe. So the universe is material, it's physical, it's changeable, it's divisible into different parts. And so for a lot of these early philosophical thinkers, they felt that that couldn't possibly be the nature of God or the divine, because God had to be completely outside of and other to the universe because he made the universe. But what I actually argue in the book is that that was a very, very, very slow cultural shift in ancient ways of thinking about this particular deity. So it only really starts to emerge around the second century BCE onwards. And even then, it didn't kind of really take hold in either earliest Christianity or earliest Judaism for several centuries. So the ways in which ancient people understood this deity to have a body, and it was really common. Most people across ancient Southwest Asia thought the same about their gods. So the Babylonians, the Assyrians, Phoenicians, Egyptians, you know, everybody had a similar sense. And the idea was that the gods were normally unobservable in their natural heavenly habitat, but they might deign to reveal themselves in various ways in the earthly realm. And one of the ways in which they did was by revealing their bodies, which were not fleshy and bloody in the same ways that our bodies are, but nonetheless, they were very similar. They were kind of made of this sort of the divine cosmic substance. But they were, to all intents and purposes, really similar to ours. They were supersized. They kind of radiated this incredible light, but they were human shaped. And, you know, and as a result, you know, they had various bits of their bodies that we have too, including, you know, genitalia and mouths and arms and legs, all the rest of it. So it's a way in which I think ancient people socialized with their gods. I mean, how do you have a social relationship with an abstract being or an abstract idea? It's really hard to have a social relationship. And so one of the ways in which ancient peoples try to kind of comprehend their imaginary or divine beings was to the idea that they had bodies that helped them to socialize with their worshippers, just as their worshippers use their bodies to socialize with their gods.
Thank you very much indeed, Francesca. So 3,000 years ago then, in the Southwest Asian lands that I suppose we can include in and call the Middle East, a group of people worshipped a complex pantheon of deities led by a father god called El. Could you tell us more about El and how that deity perhaps differs, or if there's any similarities or continuities with the interpretation of God that may be presented in any or all or some of the Abrahamic faiths that exist and are prevalent today?
Yeah, basically El is God's dad. So this was a world in which religion and the gods themselves were, it was essentially a polytheistic network. So in other words, there were many, many gods all networked together into these kind of vast heavenly households. And El was understood in the Levant to be the father of the gods. So a bit like the way that Zeus is sometimes understood in Greek mythology. So he was the head god, head of the pantheon at the very top of that tier. And he was also the father of the gods. And originally, we've got lots of different evidence, both from within the Bible and outside of the Bible, to suggest that originally this god Yahweh was understood to be one of the sons of El. But gradually over time, Yahweh usurped and eclipsed the role of his father El and took on a lot of El's roles and functions and titles, and even eventually took on El's looks. So El was a deity who had white hair and a white beard. Which didn't signify sort of degeneration. It signifies great wisdom. So originally Yahweh was a storm god. And as a result, he was understood to be quite a young, good looking, muscly deity with deep black hair and a beautifully groomed black beard. But gradually, as he kind of took over the roles and functions and traditions of his father, El, so he gradually acquired the white beard and white hair and the grizzled old looks that we tend to associate within Christian and Jewish iconography with the notion of God today.
Thank you. Okay, next, and it's looking like the final question, unless there's anything else that you want to add. I mean, the Bible has shaped our ideas to some extent, perhaps a very large extent, about God and religion, but also cultural preferences about human existence and experience, our concepts of life, death, attitudes to sex and gender, and habits about referencing eating and drinking, and our understanding of history itself. Could you take a deep dive on perhaps an example or two without spoiling what's to come in the book?
I suppose one of the most obvious is the sense that if you've got, you know, if the God of the Bible was originally understood to be a God who had a human shaped body, he was also understood to be a male deity and with male features and masculine characteristics. So in the beginning of the book of Genesis, when God says, interestingly, in plural language, he's talking to the other members of his sort of divine pantheon. He says, let us make man or humankind. The word Adam, Adam means the same thing. Let us make Adam in our image, in the likeness, you know, in our likeness. That tends to be like translated theologically by Christian and Jewish scholars as, oh, it's a spiritual correspondence between humans and God. You know, God, something, you know, we share something of the spiritual with God. But that's not what this originally meant in its context. It originally meant when God said, let us make humankind in our image, he meant let us make them have a visual correspondence. So God has a human shaped body, but by virtue, that means that humans have God shaped bodies. Now, that's had huge repercussions in terms of the ways in which we understand the hierarchy, if you like, of sex and gender conventionally within Western cultures. So to be a male or a man in a you know, it gives you a closer likeness to God than perhaps being a woman does. And that's played a really huge role in the patriarchal oppression of women through the centuries. So women are seen to be quite often, particularly in Christian theological tradition, as somehow deviant versions of this kind of divinely created image, that somehow we're not quite as good as the male or masculine form, which has a much closer correspondence to the body of God himself. So that's an example of the ways in which, you know, these texts can really screw us up in some ways.
Thank you very much indeed. Okay, the final question. I mean, a lot of our listeners aspire at researchers, some are researchers themselves. And you're researching a topic which is really, really, really interesting, but I guess it comes with the territory that's really, really, really controversial. Just if you have any anecdotes, I mean, do you get anyone from those theological communities that's very anti your work, or I suppose perhaps more surprisingly, perhaps not, do you get any that are really supportive of it and interested in it, or are they false binaries? Are they just completely disinterested? Who knows?
God, that would be terrible, wouldn't it? No, in a way, it's not a false binary. I mean, a lot of my scholarly colleagues are, you know, very much rate me and my work and love this book. Some of my scholarly colleagues who tend to be on the more conservative, traditional, confessional male side find it quite difficult. But when it comes to Christian and Jewish readers, because obviously I'm dealing primarily with those particular religious traditions, I tend to get quite a lot of hate mail from very evangelical Christian groups who see me as somebody who is blasphemous and heretical. But I'm not I don't set out to try to undermine people's faith. That's not what I'm doing. All I'm doing is saying, let's have a look at these ancient texts and traditions in their original historical cultural contexts. Because the Bible is a fantastic collection. It's like an ancient anthology collection. And I'm just saying, let's read it in the same way that we might read Homer, for example. Let's look at these texts in their ancient cultural contexts. So yeah, I do get quite a bit of pushback, but primarily from very conservative religious people who tend to push back about pretty much anything that a woman might say.
Well, look, I haven't read the book yet, but I've ordered it to my house in London when I arrived back in Britain for a couple of months for the summer holidays. I cannot wait to read it. Thank you very much for sharing your time with us today, Professor, and all the very best with the book and the Wolfson History Prize 2022, for which you are a nominee. We're so grateful. Thanks for giving up your time to come and speak to us on Versus History today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It was really nice to talk to you.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Versus History Podcast. Visit us at www.versushistory.com and follow us at Versus History on Twitter and Instagram. You can download all episodes from iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or from wherever you get your podcasts.